You're listening to a sneak peek into the most recent Chief Resident Incubator Hangout.
Hey guys, welcome to the first Google Hangout of 2018 and the second last for this year's Chief Resident Incubator. We're super, super lucky to have the amazing Dr. Dara Kass. She's a true rock star and legend, and she's going to be talking to us about developing a niche slash life after chief residency, which I know you guys are all very excited for. While, of course, she's very well known to most of you, she is, above and beyond all the other positions she holds, the founder of Feminem. And I actually want to turn the stage over to her directly so she can start talking about how she built up this amazing organization.
Well, thank you, Marie, for having me. Funny, actually, is that you say life after chief residency, and that like struck a chord at me because I was not a chief resident. It's actually there's like a cohort of us now that are still in academics that were not chief residents that kind of meet up and greet up and remind ourselves that we can still be good even if we weren't the chief resident. So Mark Silverberg, hi, how are you? Anyway, I am really happy. This is awesome. It's probably one of my most fun things to talk about is kind of career trajectory and where I got, how I got here, what got me here, and all the different things I did before I got here. So to give you guys a little bit of background, I am Dara Kass. I started Feminem 2.5 years ago. My story was that I was a resident at Kings County and downstate in Brooklyn, and then I graduated from residency in 2007. Which is a really long time ago. Anyway, and then I went to a hospital called Staten Island University Hospital as a faculty member right away. It was actually an adjunct department for where I did my residency. So it was one of our satellite programs. And I actually always wanted to do education, which is what a lot of people graduating from residency want to do, right? It's all we know. So I went and I was actually the site director for our residency at Staten Island, thinking that I would actually be an adjunct associate program director eventually. But by virtue or truth or whatever it was, Staten Island decided to start its own residency when about 2 years after I got there as the site director. So I was actually one of the most natural choices to help start a residency right away, like 2 years out of my residency choice. So we started a residency. I actually was part of a group that did, you know, wrote the program information forum and started the whole residency ourselves. And I was an assistant program director from the very beginning, which was a great experience, not one that I had expected, but it got me to understand a lot about the infrastructure of curriculum development and program development and stuff like that. In the course of that, I went to CORD, which is by far the best faculty development conference out there. The Council of Residency Directors, which you guys know. And going to my first CORD conference kind of transformed everything for me. I got to meet all the people that I had been reading about forever, and I had been hearing their voices, and I had known that they had trained the people that I had trained with. And so at CORD, I started making a lot of connections, networking with people. And at that same time, I started having my own kids. So here I was, a young female physician married to somebody outside of medicine who was having kids while building an academic career. And I was uncovering all these things that we had not ever really talked about and nobody was really giving me a landscape for. And CORD had this listserv that was really useful. And so I kept asking questions on the CORD listserv about things like, what are you doing for people for maternity leave or pumping or whatever it was? And I would get responses and I would send them out. And I kind of started developing this idea around information is like accumulation and communication. Over the next few years in CORD and within my academic career, I did a lot of asynchronous learning and curriculum development. So I became the director of the FOAM track ultimately, you know, the innovations in medical education track. And because I was an early tweeter and I was an early Facebooker and I was an early podcast listener, and I knew there was value in that. And so what ultimately happened is after, like, let's say 4 or 5 years at Staten Island, I knew two things needed to happen. I knew I needed to move institutions because I had started doing a lot of stuff that I needed a medical school behind me to do. So I thought I wanted to be a dean of students where I could influence the careers of women in medicine, not just in emergency medicine. And I wanted to be at a larger infrastructure. And so I left Staten Island to become the director of medical student education at NYU. And at the same time, I was very active in this asynchronous, you know, innovations in medical education world. And I was active in the Academy for Women in Emergency Medicine. So all these things kind of were looming around my head and happening in my world. And I was at CORD after I got SAM and ASAP and all the stuff. I'm at CORD in 2015, and I'm standing at the phone bar. So we had decided to do this kind of, you know, meet and greet area where we'd help people with their Twitter accounts and whatever it was. And this woman comes over to me, who I knew from a residency program. She was like furious, and she was like, I'm sick of this. Why do they always call me? We were like in Phoenix, Arizona, but we lived in New York, right? She was screaming that her son's school had called her for like, I don't know, the umpteenth time that he was missing from school. He was a high school junior. And he wasn't in school. He wasn't in homeroom. And so on the card, it said to call the mom, right? But the mom was in Phoenix and the dad had stayed at home for 17 years, right? Since he was born. And she always put the dad's name first and nobody ever called the dad. And why doesn't anyone do that? And what do other women in medicine do? And I was like, I've read an article about this. I don't understand. And we basically realized that all these silos had been discussing gender equity in medicine, but nobody had been communicating with each other. So if you were in AWEM, you were talking about the AWEM stuff and in SAM. And if you were in, you know, ASAP, you were talking to the AWEM group. And if you were on CORD, maybe you were on the listserv. But there was no cohort of people that they could like anchor their questions and discuss policies and articles and all the things that were happening in academics around women in medicine and gender equity and stuff like that. And so I was like, wait a minute. I kind of had the skill set. I know how to build a website. I understand social networking and marketing. I understand people. And there is this massive number of women coming up in residencies and they need help. So what are we going to do? I called my husband and I said, I have an idea. I want to make a website and I want to fund it ourselves and I want to build it. I don't want to ask permission from anybody. Because one of the things I knew was that if I had tried to do this through a formal institution, it's kind of like ALIM, right? If I tried to do it through a formal academic institution, I would have had to ask permission for every question I asked. But I was going to hit on topics that were going to be controversial. And so I didn't want anyone to tell me that it was wrong because it was not politically correct. I'm really good at not being politically correct, but I'm also really good at getting things done. So he said, go for it. You want to do this? Let's do it. And so Feminem started in 2015, in September of 2015. It's gone, it iterated like crazy since then. And then I actually stepped down from the academic world. So I went to become a per diem faculty member about 8 months ago. I don't run medical student programs anymore. I stopped being an assistant program director because you have to be the chief of only one fiefdom. And so one of the things about developing your niche is often as it changes, you may have to reframe your expectations for yourself, which is actually a really big deal. And we'll talk about a lot. Over the 4 years since I left Staten Island and since the 2.5 years that Feminem has started, I've evolved into this person. I mean, the same person, but my career looks nothing like I thought it was going to look 5 years ago. I didn't expect to own what is essentially a multimedia company, right? Feminem now has a podcast and an in-person conference and a blog and a job board and a speakers bureau. And we are now starting to write policy supporting women in medicine. We are asked for our opinion on all kinds of things. And so we're basically this kind of clearinghouse for the issues surrounding women in medicine and for the men that want to be champions. And so it's kind of awesome. Oh, and by the way, I have a flexible schedule and I don't work when I don't want to, which is the best part. So that's the story. Fair enough.
Amazing, Dara. Thank you for at least the intro. Dara, do you want to give us some of, now that we kind of have a little bit of background on you, do you want to give us some of the tips to kind of how you navigated as you were working through this changing career, especially when you're now at a point where you wouldn't have even envisioned yourself to be at 5 years ago?
So you don't have to make every decision at the same time, right? You literally have to decide one thing at a time. So you have to know, what do you like? What are you good at? What are the opportunities in front of you? And just think about that. So if you look at all the different things I've done, I kind of weighed the opportunities in front of me. I have sometimes created the right opportunity. Like if you think about it, I graduated from residency thinking I was going to be an associate program director in the program I was already in, and then didn't expect that I was going to start my own residency. And I didn't even want to. But when that was the opportunity in front of me, I took it. And then when that wasn't the right opportunity anymore, I then looked for the right opportunity. So I went out and sought out the job at NYU as opposed to just like waiting for it to come to me. I think a lot of the niche building and finding is to both be in tune with what's in front of you and being offered, and also to know what you're good at and what you want to do. And if that opportunity is not there, to seek out something that might be out there for you and to have a really, really good network. I mean, that's like fundamental to success in any career, is to have a lot of people around you and to know, have them tell you when opportunities present and have them know what you're looking for.
Perfect. I think the next step will be opening it up to the chiefs that are here. Does anybody want to start with their questions for Dara?
You had mentioned Dara, one of your supporters early on, and I'm like really big in the concept of like a board of advisors or support group that everyone kind of has. How, like whether organically or intentionally, did you like grow that network during, at the end, and like as you became like a new attending? How did you grow that network?
The answer is find people you trust, connect with them in a really organic way, stay connected with them. I mean, text messaging and Facebook are awesome for that stuff, and Twitter. And then just have a lot of them. And don't ask everybody for everything. Just go to one person every so often for the thing you need from them.
Feminem is one of those things that is taking a lead on something that has become a cultural change for all of us. And I feel like the medical field does lag behind the rest of the world by a little bit. And I wanted to kind of get your idea of how exactly disruptive marketing, how do you maintain that disruption?
I'm 80% good and 20% lucky right now. Insofar as the problems I was trying to solve were actually smaller than the problems I'm solving now. So disrupting a market, an area, to me, is all about looking at a real problem and trying to solve it and then seeing what happens, right? Like, you don't need to intentionally disrupt something. You know, it's like I just wanted to move forward on an issue that I felt was being stagnant, right? Not going anywhere. The world has moved backwards in a lot of ways since I started Feminem and moved forwards. So there's an odd disruption paradigm going on. And some of it is that as long as you're true to the problem that you're trying to solve and that you're constantly asking, is this the same problem I need to solve now that I had to solve 6 months ago? You'll always be relevant and current, which is kind of, I think, also what you're asking, right? When I set out to do Feminem, I just wanted to do a blog. I literally wanted to connect like mentors and mentees and have people know each other. I felt like I knew everybody and nobody knew each other. Now I find that I have to push the envelope on the conversation in a way I didn't have to do before. Some of it's that I have the leverage to do that because now I have a platform, I have credibility. And some of it's that the questions I'm asking and answering now are all of a sudden more relevant or even at risk of not being answered. Like, I think when I started, I was more naive and I didn't think that, I thought that if I just opened up the conversation, things would start just fixing themselves. And I know that's not going to happen, right? Somebody has to take the lead and fix these things.
I think it's a lot easier to create change in an environment that's favorable. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, there are things that you want to accomplish and projects you want to get across, but it's more in a challenging or oppositional environment. How do you really create and then maintain that change?
That's a difficult question to answer because it's totally different for everywhere. So
it depends.
I knew that I could not create Feminem in a traditional academic setting, right? Like, kind of like what I said before. Women's development programs specifically are beholden to the infrastructure of the institution, no matter the institution I was in, which is why everyone needs my help. Because even in a really progressive institution, there are still limitations to what somebody will do and how fast they'll move, especially related to a topic like gender equity. If I hadn't started Feminem separate from an institution and I was trying to do it under the guise of a formal institution, I would have been a lot more frustrated. I've learned for myself in my personality and in what I want to accomplish, it requires me to be affiliated but not employed full-time by any one institution. And that's been a great thing for me to realize. It's great insight, okay? That's not going to be true for everybody. A lot of the programs that you're going to want to do are going to have to be both like 100% affiliated with an institution, and that's going to require patience that I don't do well with, and also an understanding of political culture that I also choose to not play in. I am very bad at hiding my feelings. I am very bad at waiting. I've gotten better at it, but especially with something that I feel like is so urgent, I just want to move forward. And so I've created a world where I can. That's not true for everyone. So I think that the answer is have insight into how you work and how you're successful. Look at the skills of people that are very successful in traditional environments and look for them for guidance.
We attempted to have a contract negotiation event for women to talk about contract negotiations and how we don't ask for things. But it was met with some controversy, I guess, in our residency, whether we should open this up to men. I don't know how you guys have dealt with this in your residencies or if you guys have come up across this problem as in the past. You know, our thought was, if the men were to hold a similar thing just for men, that we obviously would not be happy about that. But the conversations would probably be different if there were men present and then if it was just a space for women. So I don't know if you guys had any thoughts about that.
So what do the men think? I'm curious.
So it was actually brought up by the men, by some of the third year male residents in our residency who wanted to know about contract negotiations and wanted to know how to deal with that, you know, as they're moving on in their careers.
So I have the same problem, but I think they just wanted to have some wine. So,
right. So I think that, okay. So I think that there's we can kind of bring this back on the rails for niche development eventually, but
yes.
When you're talking about women's programs, if you look at Feminem as an example, it's actually really inclusive. So we've had at our conference, some of our best champions at the conference were men, and we had like, you know, 20% of our speakers were men. This year, again, we're going to have some pretty amazing guy speakers, and not just because they're guys, because they have something important to say as well. One of the things that is really important is that when you do women's events, they have to have a culture of inclusion, but there are certain things that have to be, that should be separate, because there are certain issues that people want to talk about in, and I say the word safe space, but I mean that honestly, where you can be viscerally honest about something that's bothering you. And sometimes it is this kind of like burden or gender dynamic related to what you need in the workplace. That doesn't mean that men in your program shouldn't be given the opportunity to learn about negotiation, right? So if the only negotiation, like conversation your program is having is in the women's development group, then that's not good. Your program should have a negotiation series for all faculty and residents, whether it's a lawyer coming in or faculty members talking about the different contracts they got, and everyone should feel like they have that basic didactic education. Then if there is a conversation about why women don't ask, so let's say a book club about that book, and that could be inclusive too, but then it's the kind of guys that come are the ones that want to be champions and they want to be part of that conversation.
I think that segues into one of our guys
Meninder.
Ask you a question as well.
All right. Hey guys, my name is Meninder. I'm over at Jacoby Monte. I also went to Downstate, so boop boop. How do you like physically go about setting or finding a niche, right? Like, so I'm one of the conference chiefs. So all I really know is education, which is kind of what you were talking about before. In my mind, it's just, oh yeah, you know, stick with something education, like maybe take over conference. Like, you know, I didn't really have any oversight above me when I was kind of planning out the conference schedule and education and stuff. And now I'm staying at the same program. So maybe, you know, I can be that guy and, you know, try to see, I guess, what path opens up there. But I don't know if you have anything in terms of looking
education
or expanding.
Education is a good first step for everybody. Like, I think that it's what we're familiar with. It's easy to find something to be done useful. A lot of people do fellowships, which you're not doing, obviously, and that helps you develop your niche. I'd argue that if you don't feel entirely passionate about something that's a fellowship, don't do it, because it does put you in a hole that you may not want to be in. I'll call Mike and make sure that he's supervising you. He should be. But I think that for you, it's like, if you're going to stay at Jacoby, anywhere you're going to stay, it's okay to go into your job not having an answer right away. So I remember when I took my first job, I go up to my boss. It was like, I don't remember what it was like. It was like April or May before I started. I said, what's my thing? He goes, what do you mean? I said, I need to know what my thing is. He's like, you're getting a job. I was like, I know, but am I like an education person? Am I like an administration person? Like, what's my thing? And he's like, I don't know. Just learn how to be a doctor. And I was like, okay, I guess that's my thing. And like, it turns out I came in and I was director of the site. But you don't have to have a thing right away all the time. We all go into it thinking that we want to buy down our time, and that's why we want to have a thing, and we want to have a home, and we want to have a mentor. And, you know, but you could, like, if you're going to a place like Jacoby or any other academic institution, like, there are lots of opportunities in the landscape. And it's okay to take 6 months or a year to see what opportunities present themselves and then decide what your thing is, right?
It seems like finding your niche is more, it's a little bit of trial and error, right? You're not going to be able to know exactly what you want to do until you are in the thick of things and like know exactly what that niche entails. How do you though say no to people though? Because without like worrying that you're like missing out on some great opportunity.
So I think that one of the things is every opportunity is not the first or last. So you might get offered the same thing twice. Maybe if you said no, somebody might still like offer it to you again, especially if you're really honest about why you're saying no. You guys are like you're walking into a candy store of opportunities and you're like, I don't want to be full before I get to the chocolate covered Oreos. Like I don't know what to eat. I don't know if it's good. Right. Am I right or wrong? You're like giving me a thing. Right. So it's like, it's not every decision isn't the biggest decision of your life. Okay. And eventually you're going to eat the chocolate covered Oreo and it's still going to be there. Or there'll be a whole new batch. Or it's going to be a chocolate-covered gummy bear, which I discovered yesterday, which is a disgusting thing. You don't want to eat a chocolate-covered gummy bear. But the thing is that as long as you do either what your department needs and you're being a good citizen, so you might do some job that you hate within reason because it's really needed by your department, or you're going to find the jobs that make you really excited and keep you interested and you hope that they turn into like real niches, right? Like a real job. You're not going to know that right away, what you hate and what you love. So try things out, but don't overpromise yourself and don't try to do things just because you're supposed to.
As residents and then now turning into junior faculty start to build this niche or kind of start to build their brand, they're going to be taking on a lot of projects and things that have no monetary support at all. And for you to be able to take such a huge step back from
the funded academic positions or from physically just working and seeing patients, how do you then find ways for funding for these innovative projects or other things that you're hoping to get to?
I'll give you the general answer and then I'll give you my answer because I think they're very different. So the general answer is that most of the stuff that's funded is not going to be funded. That's just the way life works. And I have a couple of friends that are researchers that do research in an area that's less fun to pay for the research they like that is fun, right? Like they, because that's just the way the funding works. If you have a side project that you want to do, like a side hustle, there are actually a lot of podcasts right now on side hustles in medicine. Like there's one for women called Hippocratic Hustle. There's another one called Docs Outside the Box. And so you can listen to how people are kind of making their projects work outside of traditional academic medicine. And it's super interesting. So what did I do, right? So FemineM was never going to be funded by anybody as an entity. Like I didn't want it to be funded by an institution. It was kind of like a balance, like a balance beam. So when I started FemineM, it was a blog and I had a lot of help, but I really did it as a side gig and I was really academic and that's where my salary came from. So I always viewed it as a business. And it's not because it's not a mission-based. Clearly, everything we've been talking about today is the mission of FemineM. But I viewed it as, and Michelle and I have had this conversation a lot. I viewed it as a business because I felt like it had to be financially sustainable to be valued by me, by my husband, by society, and by the people that were going to then further facilitate its sustainability. I didn't want it to be a vanity project or a hobby. So I had a plan of how it was going to generate revenue from the beginning, but I knew I couldn't do that until I developed the community and the culture. And so once I had the culture built, I could start leveraging the culture for revenue that was based on the culture and true to the culture, if that makes any sense. And then we started adding other layers of revenue on top of it. And once the revenue got to a point where I felt like eventually it would support my time, I flipped my narrative. So I went to a per diem faculty spot. And so I left my academic title because I wanted to up the game on FemineM. And in all fairness, if I hadn't done that, we never would have had a conference or a podcast or a lot of the other innovative programs we've had. Because by not being employed at an institution full time, I have flexibility I wouldn't have had. I have autonomy I wouldn't have had. And I can generate revenue that I couldn't generate if I was, because most academic institutions, just so you know, put a cap on how much money you can earn on the side from anything loosely related to your career.
Amazing. Does anybody have any other, you know, burning questions that they have for Dara?
I have a question. I'm not sure if you're like a book person or not, but I'd love to hear what you're reading now that's interesting to you and inspirational to you, and possibly also then what books you might recommend for new early attendings, maybe things that were inspirational to you early on in your career.
I'm getting to be a bigger book person. I've been reading a lot lately. I have like a whole huge number of books in my bookshelf. I was toying with the idea of writing a book. So that's why also the book thing has become a big deal. The two books that I would say are really informative to me as a woman professional were Lean In with Amory Slaughter's book, Work Unfinished Business, Men, Women, Work, and Family. And the two books together speak to the careers of women in medicine, the choices we are making and the choices we're not making. Meaning like the things that we're being asked to do, unpaid labor, the crisis of care, all these things that happen in our lives that were really, 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 really emblematic of what I was dealing with at the time. Other books, like, I mean, I find that a lot of these transformative medicine books, like The Immortal and all those things, like, you know, When Breath Becomes Air, I find them to be inspiring as a physician because they remind me of the gift that we have to be involved in patients' lives. And I need that sometimes because I find, especially as you guys are new attendings, you're going to be really stuck. And imagining now, I'm sure, I mean, not even this year, but last year as residents, like the year before your chief year is the worst year of residency everywhere, right? Because it's the one where you're working the hardest, you're in the weeds, you don't really know why you're doing it anymore, you've lost your perspective. And then hopefully by the last year, you see the light at the end of the tunnel, you're going to start making more money, you're going to have a better schedule, whatever it is. Year one or two of an attending, you feel like you're on a hamster wheel. You know, you're getting a lot of the jobs, you're talking about not saying no to anybody, you're constantly figuring out who you are and what's going on. And half the time you're trying to figure out what your family looks like, no matter who you are. Figuring out a way that you can be inspired about medicine somewhere in there is a really good idea. And so for me, a lot of times it's reading these books that, like I don't say they sensationalize medicine, but they they remind me of the gift it is to understand what it is to be a doctor. Because at the end of the day, we're all really lucky. We're a very special sect of society. We have the opportunity to touch people in a way that is impactful and meaningful every single day we go to work. And that is not something that most people have. And I try not to, I don't forget that anymore, but I think I did for a while.
Amazing. I feel like that's a kind of an inspirational way to leave it, Dara. Perfect. Did you have any other things you felt like we didn't organically have a conversation about that you wanted as kind of final tips or advice for?
No, just remember that it'll all come together. I mean, residents and chief residents and ER doctors, like, we want all the answers right away, and they're not going to come right away. And that's okay. Sometimes space is okay too. You know, you don't have to have all the answers when you graduate. You don't have to have a perfect job. Half of you are going to quit your first job within the first year, and that's okay too. And again, the last thing I want to say actually is, sometimes when you're building your niche, you're going to have to take a leap of faith that you never thought you'd have to take. So it may mean moving across the country or quitting academics, which is like blasphemous for everybody. You might find your niche at a contract management group, which is crazy, right? And that's something that we're trained as residents to think is not the greatest path. But there are so many leadership opportunities in those groups. And the best way for people to feel like they're empowered is to be in charge of those groups in a way where physicians are in charge. You know, most of the people that work in the country don't work in academic institutions. I hate to break it to you. So one of the best things I can leave you guys with is to be open to any opportunities that are put in front of you and unpack the baggage that'll come with some of those opportunities that may make you feel like they aren't really worthy of your time or attention. You'd be surprised where you find your actual happiness.
Amazing. Well, thanks again, Dara, for spending so much time with us. And thank you to the five awesome chiefs for your guys' great questions. You guys know that Dara is super responsive to email. So you can always, I'm going to volunteer her email to all of you to be able to reach out to her as you guys are building your careers and your niches. And, you know, she's an amazing person to, if she's not the one who knows the answer, she 100% knows someone who knows the answer to whatever your questions are. So she's an amazing person to help connect you to, you know, your future areas of interest. So just keep that in mind as you continue to network and build.
Thank you guys for having me, and thank you for paying attention.
This podcast is brought to you by EBSCO Health's DynaMed Plus. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.